Hey guys, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven-figure plus e-commerce brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today on the show, we're going to be diving into part two of my series on launching e-commerce fuel capital and getting our first deal closed. And in this part, we're going to kind of pick up where we left off last week, have the fund launched, we've got it out into the world, we got the structure set up, and now it's time to go shopping for deals, start talking to people, getting to know entrepreneurs, getting hands dirty, trying to figure out how this works, how these investments work. So that's what we're covering today, covering everything from some of the things I thought were harder. We're going to talk through some of the high-level deals that I got a ways down the path with and why those didn't end up working. Talk about how many deals it took to get to our final, kind of investment in the first year. So I hope it's interesting if you're a finance geek, investment geek, or you just, kind of like seeing how the sausage is made. I hope you enjoy it. It's been a fun episode and series to do so far. Once everything was in place, I announced ECF Capital at our live event in San Antonio last year, in kind of early February, and then announced it publicly to the list in late February, early March, and probably had probably 50 applications, really strong ones right out of the gates to go through. And over the course of the next, probably 6-7 months, probably looked at 100 different deals or opportunities, maybe more, in some capacity. You know, looking at a deal book, having emails with people, probably, had at least 20 phone calls with people, individual people, probably had at least half a dozen people that I had multiple phone calls with, maybe more, maybe close to 10 before finding a deal that I liked. So biggest lesson, and I was told this by people, but you don't appreciate it until you do it, is it is a lot of work to try to look through deals and figure out what's good and what's not. Sometimes you see things out of the gate that are very obvious, that look attractive, and you dive in and they're not nearly as exciting, or vice versa. Sometimes you see things that look boring and you start peeling away the onion and you realize it's actually more interesting than you think. So sometimes it's easier to tell, sometimes it's not. But it's a lot of work to, 100 deals, looking at some capacity to find one that we eventually ended up closing on. So what was it that disqualified most deals? I think, probably the biggest one was it didn't fit the criteria. So looking at a business, and again, the kind of the big criteria for the fund were it had ideally had some proprietary competitive advantage, unique product, didn't sell a ton on Amazon, had great margins, so we're looking 50% plus gross margins, ideally a little bit higher, had strong repeat business, and ideally was in a boring or not a niche that was attracting a ton of attention. And you're never going to hit all of those. Maybe I will, and then I'll just sell everything and buy that company. But it's hard to find something that fits everything. But you want to fit, and want to find at least most of them, as many as you can. And a lot of them just didn't have it. It was kind of an easy, quick, look at those criteria, the margins, things like that, to say, hey, this just isn't in our wheelhouse where we want to play. And I actually had a spreadsheet where I would rate to keep track of all of these deals, and I had a standard spreadsheet where I would track them and I would rate the opportunity level. And then for phone calls, I also had a standard kind of list of questions I would ask, as well as a questionnaire about the founder after I got off the phone to say, am I more or less impressed with this founder than I was at the beginning? And if I had to pick between buying a mediocre business with a solid, amazing founder or a mediocre founder with an amazing business, give me the average business with an extraordinary founder every single time. It comes down to execution, and that's what I think. Obviously, you can't have a bad business model, but I think that is the more important of the two. So as I dove into it, I really was looking at the people who are running the business much more, I think, than the actual business itself. And that's one of the cool things too. One of the reasons I decided to do this ultimately is if you can have an arbitrage opportunity, that's the wrong word. If you can have a competitive advantage when you're investing where you know people and you know their character and you know their work ethic and you know what they're like, it's such a huge advantage. And we'll talk about this next episode, but the deal we ended up doing ended up being with someone who came from the e-commerce fuel community, who I've known for years. Because when you're doing due diligence on a deal, a huge part of that is, if you're buying the business or if you're investing in them, is understanding who this person is. How have they built this business up already, which is a huge predictor of either how they'll continue to build it or what are we inheriting here if we're buying the whole thing. So anyway, criteria or the founder just wasn't a good fit. Valuation was a huge one too. Man, some people are just just bat crazy when it comes to how much they think their baby is worth. I mean, there were companies I saw that were, they were doing, you know, $3, $4, $5 million in revenue with no profits, and they wanted a, you know, a $5 to $6 million valuation. That was just not a game I was interested in playing. Kind of this idea of, you know, we've got traction, we'll figure out the profitability later. And that works super well. That doesn't work. It can work in software. I think it's less likely to work in e-commerce, but, and people, I don't blame people for asking for this, because there's a lot of money sloshing around, and it's not probably, it's not easy to get money now, but it's definitely being given more freely than it was before at higher valuations. But I was very interested in and being a very disciplined on the investing approach in terms of not overpaying. I was happy to pay, you know, fairly for a great company and pay up if we needed to, but, you know, was looking to buy a company at 3, at maybe at the most 4 times seller's discretionary earning, which is their earnings plus the owner's salary back in. And wasn't really interested in really overpaying for a company unless I thought it had just insane potential. So a lot of people, the hard part too about this as well is you got to be a little careful about asking things too early. Because most people, even if they're reaching out to you about an investment, they want to know about you. They want to learn a little bit about you. And it's kind of like asking how much somebody makes, right? Like at a dinner party. You know, you may, maybe you ask your best friend, probably not even, but it's just, it's a little uncouth to do it too early. And so you have to build a little bit of a rapport, even though at some level, the whole conversation's about that. So sometimes you'd have conversations, you'd be on a second phone call with someone. You've got, between the emails and your first phone call and looking at the book, you got a couple hours into this, you know, looking into this thing, and you realize, you know, they have a wildly crazy valuation. And then you're just, well, that's just the end of it. So that disqualified people. Another thing that was hard is it's hard to get incentive structures to line up well for both people. So a couple examples, a lot of people wanted on the ground help. Hey, we'd love to have you come in and be an investor and run our Facebook advertising. Well, that's not what we're really looking for. You know, Ezra Firestone is one of our investors, and he's probably not going to run your Facebook ads. He can come in and look at them as an investor, and he can advise you on some high-level things and give you guidance and probably hop on the phone with you and give you some mentorship. I'm not going to run them for you. That's more of an agency role. Other people wanted to sell the whole thing, and that's not something that we ruled out, but it's just, unless it's in a really amazing deal, was looking for more of someone that we could invest in, give some capital to, give some expertise to through our investor base, as opposed to take over the whole ship. And the other thing is just thinking about deal structure, how people wanted, you know, or did people want, how much of the company were they willing to sell? Some people only wanted to sell maybe 10%, weren't willing to give up more than 10% of the business. But if it's a smaller business, it just, you know, it doesn't make sense for the upside for our investor group if it's that small of a business. But if we, you know, reached up into 30, 40, 50, that just wasn't comfortable for them. So the other thing is it's hard, going back to that small deal thing, it's harder to get economics on smaller deals to work out well. Let's use an example. Let's say a company, say they make 200K and you can buy it for 3X seller's discretionary earning, which again is how much the company makes added, you know, with the founder's salary added back in. Well, great. So that's like a 3X return, right? Like, which is pretty much, you know, earning back your money every 3 years if you pay 3 times earnings for it, which is a 33% return. Unbelievable. Let's do that all day long. ECF Capital is going to be huge. Hold on a second. 200K deal, if you are looking at it from an investor standpoint, you don't want to run it, because thinking through the capital standpoint, you're looking at returns without having to, not that you're not involved and help out, but you're not looking to run the day-to-day. So let's say you conservatively pay someone 75K all in to run that thing for you, which I think is conservative to find someone who's, you know, competent with some upside, taxes, all this stuff to run it. Now you're down to 125K, but you're paying 600K for the business. So effectively on an investment standpoint, your multiple goes from 3X to 5X, which is a 20% return, which still isn't, you know, it's good, but you've got to think through the amount that UCF Capital is going to take in terms of what investors get after that to make sure their return is compensated there. It's a smaller business. There's more risk. So what you realize is it's hard to make the numbers pencil on smaller deals unless you see a lot of opportunity and a lot of growth on the upside. And it's, when you're investing, you want to have as much margin of safety as possible. You don't want to, you can have a deal that's fair for everyone, but you also want to make sure you're not taking undue risk. And so going through this, realized as the process unfolded, it made more sense that penciled more easily the larger the businesses got. So I want to give you a couple examples of deals that kind of got very far down the rabbit hole, but didn't make it for one reason or another. One, there was an interesting kind of company, and I'm going to be somewhat generic here just for out of privacy for all these companies, because, you know, obviously I signed NDAs with them and I want to be sensitive to those. But there was one company in the apparel space, had a very cool product that we got really far. We were almost, I mean, we had a letter of intent drafted up. We're talking about it, almost signed with them. But what we realized at the last kind of very late on was they didn't want the money put into the company. They wanted to cash out the money. So our investment wasn't going to go towards future growth. They wanted to take the money and put it in their pocket. And from their perspective, they thought, this is great. We'll keep growing the business. We'll take some money off the table. It de-risks it for us. But from our perspective, we thought, we don't want you to de-risk it. We want you to, you know, we want it to be in the business to help it grow and also have you have most of the upside in growing the business. So our incentives are aligned. And so that one fell apart. There was an apparel company, another kind of niche apparel company, and still really like this business. Phenomenal founders. And at first blush, looked really, really attractive from a financial, like unbelievable margins, just almost too good to be true. And it was once we had the initial talk, once they came back after a couple of weeks, after I expressed a lot of interest, their accounting was off by a material amount. And so the business wasn't as profitable, anywhere near as profitable as we'd hoped. So that one, again, we probably had two or three calls on that, got pretty far down that, but that one fell apart. There was a company in the home goods space that one owner hadn't really talked to all the other stakeholders about. We had multiple calls and a great business, but it would have been, given that they were talking to me, they hadn't chatted with other, you know, the other stakeholders. One thing I realized is the more complex a deal is, the less likely it is going to get done. The more people are involved and cooks in the kitchen, and the more shareholders that have to feel like it's a great deal and have all of their needs and kind of, you know, desires for the company and all this kind of stuff line up, the less likely it is to get done. And so that one didn't blow up per se, but it was something where ultimately I looked at and said, great business, great opportunity. I think this is going to be really complicated to make it work. So kind of dropped it. There's another one, another company in the scientific space that was super interesting, but the business kind of, the bottom fell out of, like right when we were looking at them, or at least, you know, right around the same time, the world fell apart with COVID-19 and had some negative impacts on their business, and still I would have loved to invest in that business. They weren't willing to take a haircut on the value because they thought it was going to come back, which maybe it would have, but I wasn't willing to pay for top dollar or at least some significant discount for the fact that we didn't know how long it was going to take for COVID to kind of clear up and those implications for their business to recover and their business to come back. So it gets, I mean, it can get discouraging, and it's a lot of work. And from, I had a mentor when I was thinking about doing this early on say, you know what? I'm glad you're doing this. I think you're going to learn a lot. I don't know if you're going to make a lot of money the first 3 years from just from the how much time you spend on it for how much you get back. And I think, you know, it still remains to be seen, but I think looking at this in a lot of ways, as a learning process, a way to build a track record, and a way to, you know, not necessarily make a million, you know, make just insane amounts of money, but more to learn how to do it well, build a reputation, and cut my teeth. And I think he's right on that, at least for the first year or two. But I think that's like a good lesson for, I think most businesses are like that. So finally, in August, after probably close to 6 months of looking for deals, finally found a deal. And it was from someone in e-commerce Fuel who had been a member for years. I know the seller really well, and that was a big part of why we decided to buy it. A big part too of trying to, I think, the value prop for blending a community with investing, because so much of investing is, so much of finding good deals is not just the underlying business model, but knowing the person you're investing in or buying the business from. Who's a train are you hooking your caboose to? Or this sounds like a very silly analogy when I said it, but you know, who are you attaching your signing up with if you're investing as a minority partner? Or what are you buying? What type of foundation has been laid by the person you're buying it from? It's hugely important. And having insights into that from a relationship, from a network is just enormous. So a big part of one of the reasons I decided to do it in the first place was just that kind of relational advantage, or that network advantage. Anyway, so we bought from this, a deal that came from someone we really deeply trusted. found that in August, and next week we'll be talking about all the specifics there, at least in terms of details about that business and who the people were, that the key players in that and things like that. Some more details on that next week. But just a few more kind of to close out this episode for the process, how that process kind of looks since I walked through kind of the process of shopping. We talked to the seller, decided that we wanted to do the deal, and we signed what's called a letter of intent, which just has all of the high-level details of the deal. How much are we going to pay? What are the terms of the deal? When do we want to close by? How is it structured with debt and equity? Who are the parties? Things like that. And it's a non-binding letter of intent. So at that point, it really is just a good faith letter saying, hey, here's what we're going to try to do to lay it all out on the table. And you usually have a certain amount of time to do your diligence after that and kind of get the deal closed. So we signed that in, I think, September. We negotiated the deal terms. There was three people involved. ECF Capital was bringing the capital to the table. We had one person who was buying the majority of the business with a loan, with a note, SBA loan. And then we had a third party who was going to run the business for us. You'll meet all of them next week, people you almost certainly know if you've listened to the show for a while. And so with that whole structure in place, it was time to go out to investors. I remember this is the group of people that I had kind of asked for that soft commit. I had a rough idea of how much they wanted to invest. But again, this was like time to test it. Like, how many of these people are going to say, yeah, well, we signed up, but are we actually going to put our money behind you now? And so put together a deck explaining the opportunity, like a presentation. Here's the business. Here's kind of what we're hoping for returns, things like that, and took it out to them. And even though they had agreed to invest in the deals I brought, you still want to give people a sense of what they're investing in, right? Before they wire you their money. And it went well. We had a good investor call, and people, if anything, there was more interest than we expected. So people wanted to invest probably about 50% more than they committed to early on, which is great. So we upped the commitment by 50%. Up the amount of capital that we were going to put into the deal. And because there was an SBA loan in there, we also locked in the loan amount with needing less of a loan because we had more capital. So that was great. And then we had, it's funny, this is where kind of the downside of the syndicate models kicks in, where you have multiple people and stuff you don't have a fund. Again, with that fund model, you raise a bunch of money, it's in a pot, and then pretty much on every deal you do, you're the one who divvies that out because you already have it. The syndicate model, you're kind of funding on a deal by deal basis. And we had our first little glitch here where our largest investor, who made up probably about a big chunk of the capital, he kind of requested respectfully that he could withdraw from the deal for reasons. Kind of he had some other things pop up, and he's a great guy, fantastic guy. He said he would come through if it was really going to blow us up. But, I think we were able to work around it. So it wasn't a huge deal, but we had to, at that point, kind of go back, go to some of the other investors, bring a couple new investors in that could fill that hole, which just takes time, and it just takes time to do. So you're trying to kind of set up this puzzle in a way so you have enough capital. But it's a balancing act too, because you have this number you have to hit to close the deal, right? But at the same time, you don't want to put too much money into the deal, because that dilutes the returns for all the other investors. So if there's a big thing, most funds or investment groups or investment managers are judged based on the IRR they return to investors. IRR is just a fancy word for interest rate or compounding interest rate. So if you generate a 20% IRR for your investors, they earn 20% every year on their money. And the more money unnecessarily that you put into a deal, if we raised an extra $400,000, $500,000 just as a margin of safety to put into the deal, you can do that. And it's nice that you've got that margin, but then that hurts the returns that all your other investors are receiving. And so you're trying to walk this fine line between raising enough, but not so much that you hurt your returns and the returns of your investors. And so it's kind of this tightrope walk. The other thing too is you want to, with a syndicate style is, again, I know all these people, trust all these people. This reduces the risk significantly, but you also, especially having to be the first deal, push comes to shove, it's time to wire money in. Are 100% of people going to come through? Is one or two people going to maybe have some last minute issues? Something comes up, there's issues with whatever it is. You want to have a little bit of margin for that too, so that if you have one investor that doesn't come through, they don't blow up the whole deal. So you're trying to walk that balance, thinking about all these different things, but still at the same time not overly dilute the returns based on how much equity you put in. And worked out down the road really well in terms of investors. Thank you, ECF investors. You were awesome, super responsive in signing docs, getting stuff wired in for a deal like this, especially with how many people we had. But the deal, there's definitely some fireworks that kind of blew things up at the last week. We got a pretty unfortunate call on Christmas Eve for a deal that we had to close by the end of the year or pay significantly more for, or very likely pay significantly more for. So anyway, I'll talk about that more next week. And next week, again, it's when we'll be diving into the specifics of the deal we closed, why we liked it. You'll meet the players. We'll talk about the structure, the incentives, all the drama at the end, all that kind of stuff, and kind of really dive into the nitty gritty of the first deal we got closed. If this all sounds interesting to you from the role of an operator, someone who would love an investment in your business, especially from a group of people who really understand e-commerce, have been in the trenches, grown businesses, are subject area experts, check us out. Check out E-Commerce Fuel Capital. It's the real value pitch is just you get people in your corner who not only are going to be capital partners, but more importantly, you're going to be people that you can turn to and ask for insights, for mentorship, for guidance, and tap into that network of people. So you can learn more about potentially talking about and reaching out about just how that would work at ecommercefuel.com/capital. And if you'd just like to keep tabs on what we're doing, future deals that come out, just kind of stay abreast of all the E-Commerce Fuel Capital news, you can do that as well at ecommercefuel.com/capital and just enter your email address to stay up to date on all the news. That's going to do it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard and adventure often, and looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.